In many ways, Zimbabwe is a template for South Africa not to follow. And yet, we're seeing so much happening in this country which seems to be in the same playbook. So let's revisit it, and let's revisit it with somebody who's in the center of the sharp end of some crazy economic policies. His name's Ben Freeth. He's become an activist for fixing Zimbabwe, but first of all, by telling people about what went wrong. He joins us today.
Thank you, Alec.
Good to have you with us, Ben. I know you're in Zim. How long has your family been involved in Zimbabwe?
Well, my father actually got here only in the early 1980s, but my wife's family, sadly, my former wife's family, they came up from South Africa in the 1970s, but they've been Africans for over 300 years. So it's a long time working on the African continent and farming all that time.
And what took you to Zimbabwe in the first place?
In my instance, I was a teenager, and my father came to work here in Zimbabwe just after independence. And so I loved it as a teenager, and got on very well with the people here, and decided to end up staying, and I've been here essentially ever since.
So your family went to Zim after independence. So you were presumably at school, you finished. Was there any chance of moving abroad?
I did work on various farms in Australia and in the UK, just to get experience in agriculture, and then ended up coming back here to Zimbabwe and getting married in 1994 and building my house on the farm and settling down. I invested everything that I had in a new life here in Zimbabwe in 1994.
Give us a story from that point.
Well, in 1997, the farm got listed for acquisition, and there's an act that had come out a few years before in 1992 similar to you guys in South Africa, actually, a Land Acquisition Act that allowed government to take farms. But there were certain criteria that we felt were really important. Obviously, if you were productive, if you were employing lots of people, if you were economically, you know, an asset to the country and socially an asset to the country, then we didn't feel that there would be a problem. And so when 1997 came along, suddenly Mugabe, our president at the time, decided that he was needing to do something populist, and he was under pressure from the war veterans, and he listed 1,472 farms on one Friday in November. And suddenly, all hell was let loose, essentially. And at the time, there were various criteria by which we could object, and we did object, and we actually got delisted in 1998. But then in the year 2000, things got really bad. You know, basically, the law was abandoned, in essence, and we had groups of war veterans coming around from farm to farm. So what had happened was, we were a one-party state up until 1999, and it was felt that there was a swing vote on the farms, and Mugabe had to intimidate our farm workers and ourselves into making sure that we did not vote for the opposition in any way at all. And so we had these pungwis, which are all-night intimidation meetings where people get badly beaten, sometimes killed. And all our workers were brought into terrible, terrible fear. We were brought into terrible fear. People were killed. People were badly beaten. People had their homes burnt down. Farm villages were burnt down. And the police would do nothing. The police would do nothing to stop these kinds of things going on. So it was a chaotic situation in that it was sponsored by the state. The state was allowing and coordinating this wholesale destruction and violence against people and their property. And so it was a terrible time for all of us.
You drew a parallel a moment ago between the expropriation without compensation law that the ANC has pushed through in South Africa and the original legislation that was introduced in Zimbabwe. Were there significant differences between the two that South Africans can perhaps draw some courage from?
Well, there was supposed to be compensation for both land and improvements. And then in the 1992 Act, but it was government was still able to take properties. But there was legal process involved. And so we were confident that legal process would allow us to be able to continue because we were an asset to the country. We weren't a threat to the country. We were actually doing good for the country. And so we thought we would be okay, that reason would prevail, that economic sense would prevail. But then in 2000, a new constitutional amendment was then, well, it was actually a whole new constitution in which Mugabe would be able to take land now without any compensation, and he would just have to pay for the improvements. And the people actually rejected that constitution. It went to the vote, and more than 50% of the people of Zimbabwe voted against that new constitution, which was really interesting. But then in 2005, they changed the constitution anyway with Amendment Number 17, which said there will be no compensation for the land at all. And they criminalized anyone who had been listed for acquisition if they were still in their own homes or committing the crime now of farming. And so before the constitutional amendment, people were arrested because they changed the act to make it illegal to be on a property that had been listed for acquisition. And so we faced a 2-year jail term for being in our homes or for committing the crime of farming.
And the consequence of that, presumably, is that you would take a rational decision and leave the farm, did you?
Well, in our case, we decided that this was wrong, that there's no way that any law could say such a thing. You know, we'd obviously read about what had happened in 1917 in Russia and all that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, we thought, well, international law will prevail, you know. And we decided, by then, all the organizations, civil society, had basically become obsolete. You know, everyone was very afraid because bad things happened to anyone that went to court. And we as a family decided, well, we have to actually challenge this law. And I went to our lawyer, David Drury, and I said, we need to challenge this constitution. This constitution is wrong. We can't have a situation where government can just take everything for free and criminalize us for living in our own homes. And he said, well, you can't challenge the constitution. And I said, but God's law is higher than the constitution, and somehow we must. So he looked at what could be done, and we eventually ended up taking a case which we knew that we would lose because all the Supreme Court judges had been given farms. All the members of parliament, the ZANU-PF members of parliament, had been given farms. All the senior servants, civil servants, all the cabinet ministers. There were none that had not been given farms. And so we knew that those judges would rule against us because they would not want to rule against what they had done. But we felt that we still had to take the case. And so we did, and knowing that we would lose. And then by God's grace, and I can only say this was God's provision for us, a week after our case in the Supreme Court of Zimbabwe, where judgment was reserved, I heard about this SADC tribunal that had just been opened. And it was based in Windhoek, and it was for the 400 million people of Southern Africa. And it was for when justice systems failed in our own countries. And so suddenly there was this court that was open for us to use if we got a bad judgment from the Supreme Court of Zimbabwe. And of course, They then went and arrested my father-in-law and were prosecuting him for living on the farm, even though the Supreme Court hadn't yet decided. And that gave us the opportunity to then go straight to the SADC tribunal to say our domestic remedies have failed, have been exhausted. We have no law left. And we went to the SADC tribunal, and it was a hard fight. And during the process, they beat us up very severely. We got abducted. We got tortured. We had terrible things happen to us for trying to ensure that the law was obeyed, trying to ensure that sanity prevailed, that anarchy could not continue. You get punished for that kind of thing in a lawless state. And so we were very severely beaten within inches of our lives. But by God's grace, again, we survived. And we were able to go to the SADC tribunal and get an amazing judgment, which said we are not committing a crime by living in our own homes or farming, and that we can actually carry on. And so that was on the 28th of November 2008. It was a most amazing day, a glorious day, knowing that we had a judgment now that was final and binding, that could not be challenged, that was set in law as a precedent for internationally forever. Then, of course, a few months later, we went ahead, we planted a full crop, everything was going really well. And then in March 2009, President Mugabe made a speech to say that he wasn't going to listen to the court and he was going to do his own thing anyway. And with that, all hell was let loose on the farm again. And we went through a really tough 6 months where they stole all the crops, they stole all the tractors, they killed all the animals. We kind of survived in our house. They invaded the house, they set fires all around the house, they brought militia men with guns to point them at the windows of our house, they threatened to eat our children. You know, it was a really, really tough time. And then after about 6 months of this, they eventually burnt the house down, and then 3 days later burnt my parents-in-law's house down. And it was at that point that we realized, well, you know, the law is not going to prevail at this time. We need to get it off the farm. But in the fullness of time, the law will prevail, and we need to fight for that. And so from August 2009, when the house was burnt down, that's what we've been doing. And it's been a hard, long, and difficult road, but I sincerely believe that in the end, the law will win through, that truth will win through, that light will overcome the darkness, and that we will have a productive country once again, because things are not going well in Zim.
That's an extraordinary story, and thank you again for revisiting it with us. After 2009, you're off the farm. You did continue fighting, and I have to ask you where you got your inspiration from.
Well, I think what is right is right, and what is wrong is wrong. And there are two great enemies, I believe, to what is right. The first enemy is fear, and obviously there's a lot of very fearful people in Zimbabwe as a result of what has happened. And I don't blame anyone at all for being afraid in the situation that we have faced. But somehow we need to find courage. And so the antidote to fear is courage. And then the second great enemy to what is right, I think, is apathy. And people kind of thought, well, there's no hope. This is a hopeless situation. It's better just to turn our backs on it. And if we can, get out of the country. If we can't, just try and make a plan within the system that's there. I feel very strongly that fear and apathy, if we give way to fear and apathy, then things will only just get worse and worse and worse. So my inspiration for this is that right will always prevail, because God is good, and because I believe in a God who is able to work in situations. And I've seen that in my own life in so many instances. And in the story that I'm telling now, I've seen the power of God. Very often we kind of, as Christians, we want to wait for God, but very often actually God is waiting for us. And so, yeah, that's my inspiration. I believe that God wants us to be able to stand for what is right, come what may, overcome fear, overcome apathy, don't allow despair or hopelessness to overcome us, and to just keep going. And one of the things that I've actually done recently is on the 15th anniversary of the judgment in the SADC tribunal, I walked with my horse all the way from the farm gate, from Mount Carmel farm gate, right the way through to the SADC tribunal in Windhoek over a period of 3 months. And on that walk, you know, it was one foot after the other, and it was, it's hot, I'm tired, I'm hungry, my feet are blistered, but I just need to keep going. And I think that's what we need to do. We just need to keep going, even when we feel like just giving up and our feet are blistered and we're sore and we're dehydrated and we're in pain and we're feeling like giving up. We just need to keep going. And I believe that as we keep going, each step that we take, we get one step closer to our destination. And that first step from Mount Carmel Farm was, there were millions of steps ahead. But then as the days went by and the steps continued, the destination got closer, the SADC tribunal got closer. And so it brought light on the fact that what then happened was that Mugabe managed to actually close down the SADC tribunal, closed down the court, because he realized that the law was against him, that he was acting in an illegal way. And somehow he needed to close the court. And he got some of his people to help him doing that. President Zuma was one of them. And, you know, we ended up with taking President Zuma to court in your courts in South Africa. And again, all 10 judges actually ruled in our favor in that case. And President Zuma or Cyril Ramaphosa was actually instructed to then take Zuma's signature away from the document that had closed the court. And so actually there's no reason for that court to be closed, because there's not enough presidents within SADC that supported Mugabe's move to close down that court. So that court should be open for you in South Africa. It should be open for us in Zimbabwe. It should be open for all citizens everywhere within SADC to get justice when justice systems fail us. That's what the SADC Treaty is all about, is human rights, democracy, and the rule of law. The court is there to make sure that those things are upheld, and we all know what happens when they're not. So our next move is to try and get a mandamus, a court order, to compel the SADC Secretariat to reopen that tribunal.
I'm sure you'll get lots of support from the legal fraternity in South Africa once they're fully aware of the story. But Ben, where are you now? Have you participated in the apparent laws that you can get compensation or indeed even get your farm back?
No, I mean, you know, it was quite interesting. We had a coup in 2017, which no one wanted to recognize as a coup, because the Western world wanted to give our new president a chance. But it was very clearly a coup. The tanks were on the streets. The president was put under arrest. People were killed. The army was in control. And our new president came out and said, we're open for business. And he said, we're changing. And so We had a hope that things would be different under him, that there would be a return to the rule of law, that judgments like our own would be respected, that there would be a respect for property rights, and that people could go forward again. And his mantra continued to be, we're open for business. But as it turned out on the ground, you know, that was not the case. And what he did allow was certain white farmers to go back to various farms. They were not allowed to go back to their own farms. They had to go back to someone else's farm, and they had to then pay the guy that had taken that farm. Very often it's kind of 8% of turnover has to go to the guy that has actually stolen the farm, not paid for it, stolen it. And so that's obviously caused massive division within the farming community, because if you walk onto my farm and you're paying the guy that beat us up and stole everything that we ever worked for, and you're not paying me, then I'm not going to feel very gracious towards you, probably. And so it's a really difficult situation, and it's to create division. And so what then happened was that government got the Commercial Farmers Union to sign a document to say that they were happy for compensation, and it was a much watered down and a huge haircut was taken. And I wasn't involved with that because I wasn't prepared to compromise. You know, my belief is that we have to stand by the judgment that we got, which is we must be allowed back to the farms and have that option to be able to continue farming. At the moment, nothing's going on the farm. And so this global compensation deed, I think, was done without proper legal advice. It was signed in secret. The Minister of Lands actually died that morning mysteriously. You know, there were all sorts of funny things that took place over that time. And no one had actually been able to see it before it was signed. And of course, there were no safeguards in that agreement. So when government predictably didn't pay anyone, there were no penalty interest rates or anything like that. And we're now 4 years down the line from that agreement being signed, and no one's been paid. They're now saying, okay, well, we're going to offer government bonds over 10 years at 1%, which, of course, are not worth the paper they're written on. Yeah, I'm certainly not getting involved with any of those kinds of things. But there are obviously are very desperate people who are thinking, okay, well, like the story of Esau, I'm prepared to take a bowl of stew for my inheritance because I haven't got a bowl of stew at the moment. And that's the desperate situation of some farmers. And it's very sad to see that, you know, the elderly people particularly who have got nothing.
And what are you doing right now?
Well, my thing is to continue to try to hold people to account. It's very difficult in a country where law has failed so dismally. But to try to ensure that international judgments are adhered to. So one of the things that we did was I went to the House of Representatives in America, and I spoke there on two occasions, and we got our judgment and various other judgments from the SADC Tribunal incorporated into American law in the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act. We got our judgment registered in South Africa, and we sold off a house belonging to the Zimbabwe government. So we're trying to ensure that there is accountability, that there is eventually going to be a return to rule of law in Zimbabwe. But it's a long, hard, and difficult battle. But at the same time, what I'm doing is I'm involved with an organization called Foundations for Farming, where we teach people how to farm. So, you know, there's millions of people who were on the farms, you know, a couple of million people who were on the farms who now have got no jobs and their families are starving. They can't send their children to school. And we're teaching people how to farm using compost and using zero tillage and using open pollinated seed so that essentially for no money at all, they can feed their families. And so it's trying to help those who are the poorest of the poor, who are really in need. And remarkably, government has actually realized that this is something that is good, and their agricultural extension officers are being trained in this way now as well. So, you know, these are good things, but we need to also address the foundational things, and the rule of law is absolutely foundational for the country to go forward. You know, we read in the Psalms that God's throne was founded on justice and righteousness, and so we understand that that is foundational for a country to be able to go forward. If we don't have justice and righteousness, if we don't have law, then things will continue to deteriorate as they are at the moment. But eventually that all will catch up, and eventually the light will prevail, and good will prevail, right will prevail. I'm quite convinced of that. So it's just a question of keeping going. That's what we have to do.
When we started off this conversation, you referred to the parallels between the Appropriation Without Compensation Act in South Africa, which has caused a terrific furore and recently was signed into law by Cyril Ramaphosa, with the act which started it all in Zimbabwe in 1992. But there's another parallel here in your story with that of Bill Browder's. He was a hedge fund manager in Russia. His lawyer was arrested by the Russian government, Putin and co, beaten and killed after he had exposed corruption. He then went, Browder went to the United States, spoke to the House of Representatives, got a bill passed called the Magnitsky Act. And that has been a very powerful weapon for anti-corruption, in this case, against the corrupt Russians. Your act that has been passed in the United States, now that there is a new sheriff in the White House, might this become something that actually gets a bit of traction in the way that the Magnitsky Act has become adopted around the world?
I really believe that it will. And I think that the new administration in America has come down very hard on countries that are not abiding by the rule of law, that are doing things in a way that is not good for their people. And they have cut all aid, as you're probably aware, in South Africa as well. Here in Zimbabwe, no one knows what's actually happening exactly, but I was due to be seeing the Americans just after this, but because of the situation, I can only now see them on Friday. I believe that there is a real sea change in the way that America is wanting to deal with the situation in Zimbabwe and in South Africa, and this can only be positive. We need to be thankful, I think, that these measures are being taken so that hopefully some good sense will prevail, but it's not going to be an easy ride, I don't think.
How strong is that act that they passed on Zimbabwe in the United States? In other words, what teeth would Donald Trump have if he wanted to implement it?
The thing is, it's essentially a carrot. So it's called the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act. So it's basically looking at a plan to rebuild Zimbabwe if certain parameters are met, if the rule of law is brought back and if democratic principles are put in place. So all finance from World Bank and IMF and the big institutions, America has an ability to control so much of that because they put so much of the money in. And then on top of that, of course, there are the targeted sanctions against certain individuals, which hurt, you know, despite what they like to say, it's just against a few individuals. And those individuals are not allowed to go to the inauguration, for example, in Washington, D.C., even though they really wanted to go. But they can't go because of those targeted sanctions. So I think those can be strengthened and bolstered, and you know, in the end, you can rig elections and things, but you can't rig the economy. And you have to come back to sound economic principles and democratic principles where the rule of law is adhered to in order for things to start going right again.
If you were standing in front of a group of South African farmers, organized agriculture in South Africa, what would your message be to them now, particularly in the wake of the signing of the Expropriation Without Compensation Act, which I won't say has been endorsed by the Minister of Agriculture and the leader of the Democratic Alliance, John Steenhuisen, but he certainly hasn't come out kicking and screaming against it.
Zimbabwe is a perfect example to look to. I was going to say look up at because it's north, but look down at because it's been a total disaster. And, you know, we have 3 million people, we have a quarter of our population living in South Africa because it's a disaster here in Zimbabwe. So my word would be that you need to stand by the law. And what you have got in South Africa is you've got organizations like SAI with Dr. Theo Diaga, you've got AfriForum, you've got some good civil society organizations which are strong, and you need to support those organizations. And then as Christians, come together and call a massive prayer regarding it, you know, Angus Buchan or someone like that. Get Christians together to pray against lawlessness, to pray against the evil things that, and these are evil things because they cause distraction and they cause chaos and they cause poverty and hunger and things like that. It's evil. So to come together to pray and to stand by the rule of law, to stand by property rights, to stand by property rights for all, and then to reach out as well, you know, reach out to our neighbors and reach out to the poor, reach out to those that are less fortunate than ourselves. You know, that's a huge part of God's plan as well.
It's so interesting that you mention Angus Buck and a long-forgotten meeting that he held. I think it was on Ollie LaRue's farm, the former Springbok prop, near Bloemfontein, at the peak of the Gupta power. And I recall him telling me in an interview we did afterwards that as the prayers concluded, as these thousands, tens of thousands of people had come together and asked for divine intervention, that there was a whirlwind that went through the whole meeting. It was quite an extraordinary experience just to have heard what happened, and then, well, the evidence is there. I think it was a couple of weeks later that the beginning of the end started for the Guptas. Mm-hmm. So it's intriguing that you bring up the power of prayer. But outside of that, on a more secular sense, is there anything else that you would be proposing to the farming community, the agricultural community, or anybody actually in South Africa who's concerned about the EWC legislation, given the parallels that it has to the foundational Problem Act in Zimbabwe, and given the almost brushing off by many in South African society that, oh, well, it's really not that important. Cyril Ramaphosa is a good guy. He's not going to go and take anybody's farm or anybody's home away from him.
Yeah, we had the same thing in Zimbabwe, and people said, well, they've put this law in place, but they've assured us that they're not going to use it. But I said, well, they're not going to put the law in place unless they have an intention of using it. And so we need to challenge this law. And people said, no, but that's just going to create friction and conflict and whatever. Anyway, the powers that be decided they're not going to challenge the law. And so that law was used. And in our case, people were just checked into jail, just the army and the police, and they just came around farm to farm and they just arrested people and put them in jail. And because their farms had, according to the law of Zimbabwe, been acquired. And even though no one had been paid anything or there hadn't been any legal process, as far as the law of Zimbabwe was concerned, they were acquired. And so people were able to be jailed. And, you know, I think that's the thing, is where laws are bad, they have to be challenged. And what further needs to be done is that there needs to be a concerted effort to re-establish the SADC tribunal. And, you know, South Africans need to support organizations like AfriForum to help us, because legal expenses obviously are not cheap, to help us to be able to challenge these kinds of things. And hopefully the legal fraternity can come to the party as well and do pro bono work, which is something that we have received on many occasions from lawyers. So, you know, it's very important that if they make laws that are going to be harmful, that we challenge those laws and that we have the foundational principles of the rule of law able to be brought into place if your court system fails you as it failed us. You know, we had our constitutional court invaded actually by the war veterans and our judges chased away and threatened in court process back in 2001. And, you know, these kinds of things can happen in South Africa as well. And so it's so important that we stand by the law. People that don't like the law are a threat to the future and to the children of the future. And we need to stand for the future. But it's not necessarily going to be an easy ride.
And what does the future hold for you, Ben?
That's a really good question. I really hope and pray that things will change in the not too distant future. You know, things have caught up again, the economy is in tatters here in Zimbabwe. Once again, there are all sorts of problems. And eventually, you can't rig the economy. And people are, they've had enough. You know, we've had one government in power now for 45 years nearly, because it's been ZANU-PF before, and it's now ZANU-PF under the new president. So it's been the same. It's been the same government for 45 years, and we've seen a country that was so well educated, that was leading the continent in so many areas, now reduced to a poverty nation. And people know that, and they want change, and eventually that will happen. And when it will happen, we don't know. When Syria fell, when Assad fell, you know, there was no warning for that to happen. When Gaddafi fell, it was the same. When all these dictators fall, no one can predict it. It just happens. When the Berlin Wall came down, I was there. No one predicted that it would happen, but it always happens very quickly, in my experience. And when it does happen, we need to be ready for that. So it's about laying foundations for that time, creating the right alliances, making sure that the rule of law can be reestablished for the future.
Ben Freeth is a Zimbabwean. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.